Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Pianci, and I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. We are joined by a special guest today, Boaz Sabrado, a London-based financial analyst, and he is joining us to discuss a few different topics, mainly centered around cryptocurrency use in countries like Cuba, in Latin America in general, how they work, why they don't work, etc., with a focus on Tether. But to start, Boaz, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much, guys. It's an honor to be here on the show. I'm a very, very big fan. And, you know, as you guys probably suspect, I'm a little bit more of a cryptocurrency enthusiast than you are. But nevertheless, I feel that you guys provide the whole industry with a very, very valuable service. And your podcast is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. we appreciate that. But so let's start off. First of all, I guess I don't like doing backstories of how someone got into crypto. I'd rather like to understand how you came to understand its use case in places like Cuba, which, as far as I know, most people haven't been to. So
the whole Cuba story for me personally is one where, you know, you have to rewind back to 2016, back when, you know, Obama was in power. Right? He goes to Havana, right, in this historical trip. And it looks like there's this great reset in the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. And as a young person that was entrepreneurial and spoke Spanish, I said, wow, this is a fantastic opportunity to go to Cuba and try to start something. Now, this was a terrible mistake for reasons that you're going to find out about soon. But that's what I thought at the time. So in 2016, I went to Cuba, made some contacts, etc., and I ended up within the 2 years, I kind of had a business there that had employees, that had suppliers. What we did was basically sell tourism services online. So it was mostly accommodation, some transportation. You know, by the peak of things, we were running something like 25% of Cuba's sort of hostel bed inventory online. We're doing all the online marketing and inventory management, all of that stuff for them. And in 2018, I kind of fell down the crypto rabbit hole, as people like to say, for two different reasons. First of all, I discovered that it was a lot cheaper for me to move money into Cuba via cryptocurrency. So what I did back then...
Why is that?
I want to give you... Sorry, yeah, why? Let's take a step back. I'm going to give your audience a little bit of a context of around the Cuba situation, what Cuba is, the laws around Cuba, etc., because I think particularly the American audience might not be fully aware. So the business that I was running, which is a tourism e-commerce thing, is completely legal. Like, I had a European registered company that was paying taxes. I wasn't breaking any U.S. laws around sanctions, etc. I did no business with the Cuban government. I did no business with Cuban government, military on hotels, etc. These are all activities that the U.S. government encourages, in fact, and were part of Obama's big plan. And to this day, are legal, and they have been for a long time, etc. So let's get that out of the way. I don't want to be, accused of being a sanctions violator, etc. So I was running this business, and then I discovered that for me, as a European person that has a European company, the cheapest way of actually moving money into Cuba that I needed to do to pay off suppliers and pay off people that, you know, I had to pay their employees, etc., was actually to buy Bitcoin in Europe and sell it in Cuba. So that was one of the things that kind of opened my eyes.
What's the process of selling Bitcoin in Cuba look like? Like, what do both ends of that transfer look like?
Okay, so I'm going to caveat this with the fact that this was 2018, sure. 2019. Since COVID, I've not been familiar with the market. But basically, the way it worked is you kind of found someone in a Telegram group or something like that, and you message them, and you built up a relationship, and they agreed to either give you the cash in person or to wire you the money, and you sent them the coin. There's no exchanges operating in Cuba at the time. I think to this day, there aren't any exchanges operating.
So my question here is, why is it so expensive to move fiat currency whatever. If you're using pounds and you're in London, if you're using U.S. dollars in America, and I assume I know the answer to this, but I would like to hear like to hear you explain it.
So it's very expensive to move money to Cuba because Cuba is sanctioned. A lot of Cuba's economy is sanctioned under U.S. laws. So even if you're doing something that's completely legal, if you're a big dog like Airbnb or Booking.com, you have clever lawyers and clever bankers and good banking relationships, so you can actually figure out how to move money there. It's actually quite interesting. The way Airbnb moves money to Cuba right now is they have, I mean, I'm not entirely sure if this is true, but I know it's true that they use a company called Bakua, which has some dodgy Miami links. And the rumors I heard, I'm not sure these are true, but what I've been told is they literally fly someone over from Miami to Havana every single week with a bunch of cash to do this. So the U.S. sanctions make it very impossible. You can't really use SWIFT to wire money to Cuba. The only European banks that will allow you to do them are, funnily enough, state-owned European banks. So state-owned European banks will let you use a SWIFT messaging service to send money to Cuba because, you know, as you guys know, Europe does not sanction the U.S. and the state banks are, you know, brave enough to try to do this. Effectively, the cheapest fiat way that we'd found to move money to Cuba was literally, like, I sent over a bunch of debit cards to the people that worked there, and they went to an ATM and withdrew cash. And that cost us roughly 5%. Now, if you can think of that, that's 5% of your expenses as a business. That's quite a lot of money. When we're doing the Bitcoin transactions, we were actually getting paid 10% above market value to sell Bitcoin because at the time the market was so new. We were one of the biggest players there, and we ended up making significant profit on that.
Is that due to arbitrage? Like you would purchase it for some price in let's say London, and then you would send that Bitcoin over, and essentially, I assume, and tell me if I'm, I don't want to accuse you of anything, but essentially up market a little bit because demand is higher in Cuba for it, or?
Basically, at the time that was the case. At the time, this is no longer true, by the way, but at the time there was such little liquidity and so high demand for cryptocurrency in Cuba that you could sell it for more than the spot rate internationally. By the way, if you guys follow peer-to-peer markets, this sort of thing is uncommon but not unheard of. This does happen quite a lot. The kimchi premium is known, right? In Korea as well, you get premium for cryptocurrency.
Iran for a while had a very nice, big, thick premium as well. Sanctioned countries that don't have access to U.S. dollars tend to see a bit of a spiked premium. Korea is a different, I don't know, it's a weird case.
Korea's capital controls mostly. And then there's a very, very interesting case of countries that have a discount. Colombia has had a persistent discount for a very long time. Haven't really seen anyone write about it, but it's been there. And
why is
it
that?
Exists.
Do you have any theories?
I don't know. My theories are basically speculation. But there's someone in Colombia that really needs to sell Bitcoin through peer-to-peer markets. I don't know what that means.
Wonder who that could be.
So, but on the other side, can you talk about some of the things that drive demand in places like Cuba and why there is so much demand for cryptocurrency in places like that?
Okay. So basically, in Cuba, if you want to get your money out of the country, you don't really have any other way of doing it. If you want to, Cuba's not the way that many people in the US or Miami imagine it to be. There are many people who are small business owners in Cuba that may have amassed, a substantial amount of money. They're not by no means multimillionaires, but, they're people that, own a restaurant or a hotel and they make okay money because they sell to foreigners. If you want to, say, move out of the country and go to Miami or go somewhere that doesn't have power cuts every day, you need to get your money out of the country. Now, that isn't possible in Cuba because they have capital controls. So the only thing you can really do is you can sell for cryptocurrency and move it out. Or you can use sort of, other unofficial money mules and people that will do this as a service. So that's one of the sources of demand for cryptocurrency in Cuba. Back when we were selling, 2018, 2019, there was another source of significant demand, which I've written about and I've spoken about, which was people who were wanting to buy cryptocurrencies to participate in MLM and Ponzi schemes.
So can you talk a little bit about the dynamics of how crypto feeds into those multi-level marketing and Ponzi schemes in places like Cuba?
Yeah, so that's it's a very, very interesting question because you kind of saw something similar, you know, in the 1990s in Eastern Europe when, you know, there's the fall of the Berlin Wall. And all of a sudden, all these countries that were, you know, there's no market economy, there's no business. It's just, you know, they get flooded with all these opportunities, you know, new Western companies, everything looks amazing, new technology. And there is no sort of societal antibody towards Ponzi schemes or MLM schemes, right? You know, you had in Romania, I think, Cass, you wrote about the Caritas Ponzi, which is one, you know, between $1 and $5 billion worth of a Ponzi scheme. There was a small civil war in Albania after a Ponzi scheme blew up.
MMM was the other one. Sorry, MMM was the other one. That's a Russian Ponzi scheme that appeared after the fall of the Berlin Wall and went on for several years. There's like a second version that's crypto-based now as well. But yeah, certain places that are ripe for Ponzi schemes, like obviously we have our fair share of scams in Europe and in the United States of America, Canada, like the Western world. We definitely have that. But I would suggest that there's places where when you're introduced to new capital flowing in and you don't understand how certain concepts work because it's been so long since you even have had to interact with like free market economy, that you just think, like, especially in the case of Caritas, I think it was a lot of like, well, this is just how capitalism works, right? Like, we just make money. So I think that at least that's what I'm kind of hearing here is that that's a bit of the issue in these places.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. In fact, there's this other Ponzi scheme, MLM scheme called Forsage, which is a sort of Ethereum smart contract based Ponzi scheme, where basically it's similar to MLM scheme, right? You get recruited and then you get incentivized to recruit more people, etc. And there's a paper that came out recently that was super interesting for two reasons. First of all, they actually did the sort of chain analysis and they proved that, yeah, I mean, it's obvious to us, but like, okay, 88% of users lost money in this. Secondly, they actually did some pretty clever analysis to figure out where the users were actually from, people that participated in this. And they found that it was overwhelmingly, you know, in countries like Nigeria, Indonesia, India, you know, places where, you know, first of all, they might not be as familiar with this sort of thing. It's hard to differentiate technology from an outright scam. And there's less economic opportunity sometimes for people. So they decided to participate in these things. There were two very big ones in Cuba back when I was, you know, I got to be there. One of them was called Carrot Bars, which was run by a German former vacuum cleaner salesman who eventually got, I think, some charges pressed against him. I don't know if he ever went to jail. But basically, they had events in Miami and Amsterdam, etc. And they managed to recruit a very, very, you know, wide audience of Cubans. And they had their own token, which, as you can guess, it went to zero. And a lot of people lost their money. But the bigger one, and this is one that kind of blew my mind, is one that was called Trust Investing, which was a very, very simple crypto Ponzi scheme in the sense of you deposit us money, we're going to do magic arbitrage to give you 10% yields. And they tried to do this in perpetuity. And the Cuban authorities, despite, you know, Cuba being a police state, only moved against one of the local organizers in April of 2021. So for a very, very long time, this guy was operating it with impunity. Only after they started having issues, they actually moved to arrest him. And then they actually let him go a little bit. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But the reason why I bring this one up is because it was very, very devastating in Cuba. Mm. Tens of thousands of people who didn't have that much money. You know, keep in mind, the average salary in Cuba is something like $20, $30 if you work for a state company. A month. They didn't have that much money, but they were putting all their savings into this scam. And, you know, something like 44% of all the trust investing users were based in Cuba, with the rest around, you know, wherever the Cuban diaspora was. So one of the big novelties of cryptocurrency is that these Ponzi scheme operators can tap into, you know, so-called virgin markets, right? And even if Cubans don't have that much money, if you can get 70,000 of them to participate in your scam, you're probably already doing quite well, right? And this whole OneCoin thing that came out a few years ago, that was also going around developing countries as well.
And in a country as small as Cuba, I mean, there's only like 11 million people there. If it affects 50,000, 70,000, 100,000 people, like, you know one of these people. You know one of these people if you live there, for sure. That's a lot. That's crazy. But now that we've kind of run through some of the offensive parts of this stuff, and also spoke of why you were personally attracted to using Bitcoin in Cuba when you were working there, I'd be interested to hear your takes on Tether in places like Cuba, because I suspect we're going to disagree, or at least if not disagree, I at least will begrudgingly admit that you might be right while saying Tether is not the right vehicle for that purpose. But please, let's hear it.
Okay, so with regards to Tether, I want to step back because I think I've given you guys half my crypto story. So the story I told you is like, okay, I found that crypto was the best way for me to do, you know, Bitcoin was the best way for me to do cross-border transfers. I mean, I think there's fairly well-established literature on that. It's kind of evident that that's a thing that people are doing. But the other part of my story of why I end up using, you know, and becoming somewhat of a cryptocurrency enthusiast is that, you know, so in 2016, I first go to Cuba. By 2018, we have a business, we have employees, we have suppliers, we have hundreds of guests staying with us. And the other thing that happens in 2016 is that Donald Trump gets elected. So we go from the sort of Obama years of, okay, we're going to mend things and we're going to encourage, the U.S. Embassy was encouraging Airbnb and Stripe and other companies to set up shop in Cuba. And then with Trump's election, things kind of change. And in 2018, I get an email. So I was using Stripe as a payment processor, right? So Stripe had been brought in by the Obama administration to deal with this, to deal with businesses, Cuban business people that wanted to do business in Cuba. And on the 5th of March of 2018, I get an email. I'm checking it right now. And they say, on the 16th of June, 2017, the U.S. government announced new restrictions for firms, businesses working with connections to Cuba. By the way, the actual law was no substantial change. It was a very Trumpian, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But when you actually looked at the new laws and the new rules, nothing actually changed. And they continue the email. They say, as a result, we've made the decision to deactivate user accounts that may conflict with this new policy, or, and here I'm quoting them, or where we may be unable to meet increasing compliance oversight obligations. So the way I understood this was basically, you're too small for us to matter. This is kind of an unprofitable business for us because we're going to have to get all these lawyers involved and it's just a little bit sticky. So we're going to give you, how much did they give us? Oh, they gave me effective today. So they gave me nothing, 0 hours to figure things out, right?
Yikes. I have some friends at Stripe. I would love to hear them tell me a little bit about why you were given like 24 hours. That's not a good look, but sorry.
I mean, but these things happen. Listen, they happen.
24 hours is pretty insane. What if you just don't check your email? You know what I mean? Like that seems pretty unacceptable to me. You're being really laid back and chill about it. But for me, that is really unacceptable. So I'd love to hear, I know there's a couple listeners out there who work for Stripe, and I would love for them to talk to me about why this happened. It doesn't have to be on the record. I'd just like to understand why.
I mean, listen, from their perspective, it makes total sense. This is no longer a profitable business. This is a compliance risk. This isn't a big company. And I'll be honest with you, I've been deplatformed by Stripe, by Revolut, by PayPal. By far the best experience was Stripe. So I'm a Stripe fan here, okay? But none of them were as essential as Stripe. And I'm going to tell you what happened after this. So keep in mind, I have suppliers to pay and employee salaries to pay. in Cuba, and I cannot charge cards. So I do some desperate searching, Googling. I'm on the phone all the time trying to find a payment processor that's willing to take us. And the first one that says yes is an Argentinian company called Smile Wallet. So I signed up to Smile Wallet in June of 2018. Keep in mind, between March and June, I can't charge a single card. So I'm plowing in my savings, I'm borrowing money, I'm doing all this crazy stuff so I can pay off the suppliers. Finally, I get this deal signed with Smile Wallet, and I start using them, and they're kind of dodgy. Like, you can kind of tell from the conversations you're having with them. They're telling you to keep the money in their accounts. They're charging you a lot of money. You call them, there's people, like, babies screaming in the background. Like, something's not right. So as soon as I can, I find another supplier. Less than 6 months later, Treasury, OFAC, Department of Justice, DEA, basically shut down Smile Wallet, because it turns out that that was a money laundering arm of a heroin and opium smuggling operation. Okay, so what did I learn from this? Basically, completely frivolous political rules pushed me. And by the way, I got away scot-free because I was fine. But there's articles on the internet about this. Tens of thousands of people lost all their money. Yeah. Because they didn't know that they shouldn't leave their money with these Argentinian money launderers. The guy, the founder is called Enrico Ferrari, by the way, which is a crazy fucking name to have if you're a money launderer. You know, the conclusion I draw from this is like, okay, so we have these rules that change all of a sudden. You push, like, innocent people into the hands of these criminals, and you're constantly at risk of being deplatformed and seizing your fund, you know, losing access to your funds all of a sudden. What happened to me with Revolut, which is a very, very similar story, I basically lost funds, access to the company funds for a year. For 6 months, they said nothing to me. And it was only when I took them to court that I managed to get access to my funds back. Now, while I was going through this process, I spoke to a bunch of people that were similarly affected. There was articles all over European press. Basically, what I think had happened is Revolut's KYC and AML standards were super, super lax. They got in trouble with regulators, and they just ramped them up at some point to, like, okay, like, we're going to go through this backlog of things we should have flagged in the past. And then their own customer service people didn't have time to actually go through them, etc. So they had this, like, very blunt force way of dealing with things. But basically, a lot of people lost access to money that they needed to pay a deposit for a mortgage, to pay for employees, to pay for rent. You know, so these sort of experiences have, you know, helped me kind of understand why it is that people value platforms like Tether that much. Because, you know, if you're using Tether, you know, you guys know more about Tether's backing than I do. You know, Tether.
No one knows anything about Tether's backing, but please go on.
Okay. So Tether might disappear next month, right? And then, you know, there's going to be billions of dollars that are lost, and it's going to be terrible. But what Tether won't do is Tether won't freeze your funds capriciously for no good reason, and then you have to get a lawyer and et cetera, right? Tether doesn't do any of that.
Well, they freeze Tethers regularly.
They freeze more than Circle and Paxos combined.
They do freeze them, but as a percentage of, like, users, it's such a small amount. It's literally just like the you know, how many is it? Like 20-something, 100-something addresses?
Ethereum, there's another dozen or so on Omni, another bunch on Tron, a separate set. Like, you have to go across.
You'd hope there'd be some on all of the blockchains, but...
Right, but like as a percentage of accounts that get deplatformed on platforms like Stripe or PayPal or whatever, that's a very, very small percentage.
But on that same note, I wonder how many people are getting deplatformed, like in European banking or American banking, as a percentage of the total population. Like, I would suspect it is also insanely low, especially when people talk about KYC AML processes and how they are expensive and monolithic, But and yet we look at how many big operations get flagged and it's few and far between.
I think the issue, Cass, is that it matters who you are. So if you're if you're like the Mexican cartel that's doing business with HSBC, or you're a big company with a lot of money in the bank account and influence and lawyers, then you're probably going to be fine. If you're a small business owner or a solo entrepreneur or something, it's just the banks and the financial institutions' cost-benefit analysis of, okay, we're going to sit down and actually figure out what's going on versus we're going to, fuck with this customer's cost as business. It's kind of, the calculation's kind of different, right? So effectively what you end up with is a system that doesn't stop the big wide-scale money laundering, and those guys get away with impunity, but it imposes substantial costs on small businesses and individuals, particularly if you happen to be unfortunate enough to not be born to one of the countries of what is known as the first world, right? Because if you I was born in Hungary, I grew up in Costa Rica. I have to go through all sorts of KYC nonsense, So, for instance, let me give you an example, Cass. Like, when I lived in Costa Rica, and I have lived in Costa Rica in the past, very often you'd sign up to a service and they'd be like, okay, like, give me your, like, street name and address. Now, here's the thing, guys. There's no street names in Costa Rica. Like, they don't exist. And then you're like there in this sort of situation where, like, okay, like, whoever thought about this KYC process didn't think about this. What do I do? You get flagged up. There's all sorts of things, etc. So listen, I don't have like clear numbers as to how many people are inconvenienced by these KYC processes. Anecdotally, I think it's quite a lot of people. And when they impact someone, it can be substantial because it can mean a missed
of course.
Mortgage payment. It can mean a missed, salary, etc. But I do know that the UN put out these numbers about, okay, what percentage of illicit funds do we actually manage to attach? And it's less than 1%. And I know that people are spending hundreds of billions of dollars on KYC.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit when Josh Cincinnati was on, and our basic conclusion was that
as well.
At the very least, most of the transaction monitoring is not achieving what it's purported to.
Right. I do want to say though, this is my next question for you, Boaz, is so your suggestion is that for a lot of people where perhaps this KYC AML process is burdensome, if not impossible to complete, the suggestion that they use Tether mean that Tether doesn't do that? Or are you suggesting instead, which I believe is what you're suggesting, that these people are using Tether that they trade for? They're not going out to Tether and minting new Tethers themselves. They're not going and redeeming Tethers with Tether. They are simply holding Tethers and trading them for other goods at some point in time.
Exactly. So think of a use case. Think that you're someone in Cuba who wants to move money to the US. You're relatively well off. You've done well in business. You have a grandmother that lives in Miami. You want to send her some money for her birthday, let's say $100 or something, right? Or you have an uncle or cousin, some family member, right? So you could try to open like a fake PayPal account and somehow top it up and send money to their like bank account or PayPal account. You could use Zelle or Venmo. A lot of people do that kind of stuff. Now, the chances of you getting caught on like this whole KYC thing are, I mean, you might get through, but I think there's substantial chances that, they'll ask you to prove your identity and then you lose that access to those funds because you cannot prove that you're not a Cuban resident because you are a Cuban resident and they don't want to serve you, right? The other alternative is that you buy Tether off someone on an exchange or something, in some Telegram group. You buy $100 worth of Tether and you simply send it over to someone's, Coinbase account, whatever. They can sell it locally in the US and then they have the $100. So you as a Tether user, you're not actually holding Tether for that long. So even if you don't believe in the backing of Tether, you have your own, skepticism around it. You wouldn't necessarily keep your money in it for very long. For the, you know, purposes of a transaction that takes 10 minutes or so, you know, and most of these people are using Tron, which is why Tether on Tron is
oh, you're killing me, Boaz. You're fucking killing me, man. Damn it.
So that's the thing. I mean, like if you're not holding it for very long, you don't care about the backing of it of that much. And you're not redeeming it. You're not getting it, right? You're just transferring the money very quickly. And, you know, you pass on the risk to someone else that is happy to take Tether one-to-one to the dollar.
So I think that, like...
Yeah, that's how... I mean, but that's how schemes work, though, right?
Well, yeah. I think that there is probably a use case in Tether and other stablecoins for remittances, especially in place where more regulated payment processors are not able to operate or choose not to operate because of the difficulties. But part of my struggle is, like, if stablecoins get adopted in that way, I imagine they would keep working for a lot of the small users. But for businesses and larger users that started using it, why wouldn't governments start putting pressure on the stablecoin issuers to start going after once they identify an address is tied to a certain business? Why should they not freeze that address, right? Why shouldn't the Treasury call up Circle or Center or whatever and tell them to do that?
I agree with you 100%, and I'm going to give you another scenario. What if it spreads, and what if it becomes a dominant medium of exchange where, you know, almost everyone and their grandmother uses it, and then we discover that the backing is not what we thought it was, there's a bank run, a lot of very, very innocent people are going to get hurt that don't necessarily care about crypto, they don't necessarily know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, to a certain extent, you kind of saw that already with the whole Luna fiasco. Right? A bunch of people who didn't know what they were doing, who heard something about stablecoin returns, ended up getting very, very hurt. So I think it's definitely a double-edged sword. The point I'm not trying to make is not about the long-term sustainability of it or whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. The point I'm trying to make is that as a consumer, there are situations in which the rational choice for you is to use a stablecoin over any other means of payment.
Yeah, I totally understand the idea of, like, I think I've said this before on the I think when we did an episode about Bitcoin. For me, I understand deeply just via the people that I know in certain countries. Even though I haven't had to resort to that, thankfully, I do understand, and I could perceive a world where I would need to. The only way I could possibly get them money in any way, shape, or form in could be cryptocurrency. And obviously, if you're going to be trying to do a remittance, you don't want it to be highly volatile, because by the time it gets over there, it could lose 20 or 40 or 50% or more, or, you know, whatever. So I think I do understand that. I guess I just my issues are that the inherent risks that are being pushed aside to accomplish that feat seems to be kind of, I don't know, like, it's almost insane to me to think about where blockchain and cryptocurrency started and how it was about decentralization, privacy, censorship resistance. And then everyone's like, hey, fuck it, let's use Tether on Tron. It's like, guys, holy shit, not decentralized. The worst blockchain explorer I've ever tried to utilize. Like, Justin Sun is the, I don't know, like, the bane of my existence here. And Tether, like, you're combining all the worst parts of the space and the industry and being like, this is what crypto stands for. Not you. I'm not suggesting you're saying this, but I am saying that, like, knowing that this is what people are utilizing in places where they need cryptocurrency, air quotes there for everyone not watching. Okay. So, yeah, I don't know. It's like I struggle to kind of, like, match those two perspectives. You know what I mean?
Okay, so I have two answers to that. So first of all, if you're a consumer that wants to send over a couple hundred bucks from one country to the other and you use Tether, for you, functionally, there's no difference between Tether collapsing while you're making that transaction
or you getting stuck in some KYC AML black hole at PayPal or at any other company. Because in both cases, you've kind of lost your money. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one point. You're taking risks in both cases. To the other point as to, you know, how have we gone from, you know, fully decentralized Bitcoiners running a node on their own laptop to people, you know, basically transacting with a trusted coin called Tether on Justin Sun's, you know, quote unquote, decentralized network. Now, I have a theory about this, which is that in the last couple of years, cryptocurrencies have discovered that, okay, so I don't know if you guys remember, but like at the very beginning of blockchain and crypto and Bitcoin, people were like, oh, the government's going to shut this down immediately. You know, the government won't stand for this. I think in the last couple of years, people have realized, actually, the government doesn't really know what's going on. They're too slow to react. They're not really doing anything about it. So we don't actually need to make it that censorship resistant. We can, like, as long as it's like lawyer and regulator resistant, we might be able to get away with increasingly centralizing things. Because you have to remember, like, you know, decentralizing these platforms comes at a terrible expense,
yes.
Right? You know, with you know, Bitcoin pays miners a lot of money so that it can stay relatively decentralized. The nodes, you know, the whole, you know, how many megabytes is in the block, you know, there's a lot of design constraints to making a system actually decentralized, right? But if you don't need it, then you're going to drift towards this more and more centralized solution.
But I wonder, I guess here, so sorry to interrupt, but I wonder if you're not fully decentralized, right? If you're not like actually legitimately decentralized, such as Bitcoin, which like who knows who Satoshi was, but if he or she or they revealed themselves tomorrow, I don't think anyone could do anything to prosecute them. What's done is done. Good on you, man. Like, oh, well, there you are. Obviously, he'd be a prime assassination target. So I don't know. That would be a bad move if he decides to do it. Other than our boy Craig Wright, who obviously is Satoshi. Right, boys?
Oh,
anyway,
God, Cass.
Other than those platforms, sarcasm for anyone who is wondering. But other than that, if I think about like Tron, it feels like, I don't know how many nodes there are, but I feel like it would be easy to shut that shit down. I feel like it would not take that much work. And also, when it comes to this, people talk about Tether and how it's on all these blockchains and therefore, like, maybe it's impossible to stop. I'm like, dude, it's just a company. It's not impossible to stop. It takes, like, arresting three people and it's over. I guess I just wonder, if you're not fully decentralized, are you regulatory resistant? Are you lawyer resistant? I don't think so.
I tend to agree with you. I think that what you achieve is you buy yourself some time, but eventually I think the regulators and the lawyers are going to come for you. And I think, listen, it's no coincidence that Justin Sun has acquired this diplomat status, right? You know, he's probably feeling the heat here. Listen, I think what's probably going to happen in cryptocurrency is that there has been this sort of push to centralize further. I've spoken to exchange operators who won't be named that run their own nodes for all of the blockchains that they support. And they told me, and I'm not sure if this is true, but I heard that, for instance, with Solana, unless you're physically co-located with all the other Solana nodes, there's basically no way for you to catch up to the tip because the block speed is basically so close to the speed of light that it's just not possible for like a node that's not co-located to actually operate, you know, in a satisfactory manner. Right? And so there's this drive towards efficiency and getting rid of these decentralization constraints, which inevitably leads to centralization, yeah. Right? So here's the thing then. At some point, the regulators are going to come knocking. There's going to be the whole, some crypto, whatever that event was when they got rid of the offline poker sites and all that. There's going to be a Black Friday. There's going to be some event where we're going to see who's left standing, right? I think a lot of the crypto projects that seem to be super successful because, you know, they're really quick, really good, like Tron, might turn out not to be as decentralized and censorship resistant as they possibly advertise themselves to be.
Yeah, and this is really kind of one of my fears with Tether being used by more retail, by more normal people, is that it works well if you are liquidating it on the other end of the remittance, right? And you aren't holding Tether. But the longer Tether exists, the more people start to believe it really is basically always worth a dollar. The more they start treating it like that and storing wealth and stuff in it, the more dangerous it becomes for those same users. And it's kind of, and you kind of see a parallel with that in crypto, with the spectrum between decentralization and centralization, is you get all these gains by pushing yourself closer and closer to centralization while you're able to do it until it breaks and then everyone's ruined.
Yeah. So on that point, I'm gonna mention two things. So first of all, I think the fact that retail consumers around the globe feel the need to use Tether to transact in remittances is effectively, it's a regulatory failure. You know, the fact that legitimate people cannot use, you know, the existing financial infrastructure to move money around for legitimate reasons without excessive red tape and capital controls and et cetera, I think that's a regulatory failure, and you wouldn't see it if we had a reasonable KYC AML regime. That's one point. The other point is going to be slightly more controversial here on this this podcast. I think that we are probably past the peak of when Tether was a substantial systemic risk to the whole cryptocurrency ecosystem. The market cap of Tether relative to other stable coins has been going down for what, 2-3 years? No, 2 years already. It's increasingly less of a systemic risk. Moreover, there is a very, very interesting podcast with I don't know how to pronounce it, Galois Capital, the guy that shorted Luna basically when that happened. And he came up with a thesis, which I've kind of started entertaining. And keep in mind, I don't know anything that you guys don't. You guys know Tether better than I do. That basically his thesis was that Tether probably didn't always have the money when they did, you know, when they claimed they did. But that at this point, they did a bunch of wild shit, and they're actually probably well capitalized, if not overcapitalized by now, and they should probably stop doing wild shit. Those are his words.
Okay, so I just want to say something that Bennett and I have both been saying for years, as well as Bitfinex, who has also made sure that this is. I want to make sure people don't think that our only theory on this is that there is $0 backing Tether. That is not the theory. That is not the running theory.
Yeah.
It is very possible that there is essentially, in terms of assets, obviously it isn't dollars, but in terms of assets, a one-to-one backing of sorts. How that capitalization happened, how they got that one-to-one backing, is the biggest problem they face. Because if it was highly illegal, like let's say insider trading or bank fraud or wire fraud or who knows, like any number of things that they shouldn't have been doing, then they can never get an audit, like the audits that they keep fucking promising to everybody. Go ahead, Ben.
I also struggle with like saying Tether is very well capitalized because they publish transparency reports. We know their capital cushion is 160 million on greater than 75 billion in assets. And that's assuming they're valuing all of their assets fairly. I think the statement that Tether could redeem all Tethers in circulation is not something that most people would agree with. And I don't think is true based on what we publicly know about Tether. I think that plenty of evidence from Tether's own materials to suggest that is likely not true. And so I think anyone suggesting that Tether is overcapitalized and has more funds than they're suggesting when their capital cushion is as small as they disclose better have a compelling reason to suggest that.
And this is as they get into things like Keat and other weird ideas that are like, oh, this is what you're pivoting to? Video messaging app? Okay. I don't know, man. Like, it sure raises a ton of red flags. One other thing I did want to add onto your statement, though, is that besides those two failures you mentioned, for me, the most glaring failure regulatory-wise is that these guys, who maybe they do have all the assets they claim they have and everything is A-OK over at Tether, but as far as anyone knows, they've been counterfeiting all the money that they've ever had. And if that is the case, they were able to do that for years under the nose of regulators who did nothing. So I like that is the biggest failure in my mind is like, oh, if you want to fucking counterfeit $1 billion, go right ahead and do it. No one's going to stop you. Even though I'm not recommending anyone do that. Let me be clear. But yeah, I like for me, it was a horrifying example of regulatory failure.
I think we can all agree that there's a lot of regulatory failure here. I mean, the whole Luna chaos could have probably been avoided if they, you know, if it was nipped in the bud. There's a lot of things that the regulator didn't do, and there's a lot of things that they're doing instead, which is kind of going after small fish, you know, at companies like Coinbase and OpenSea, and not dealing with the real problems.
Those two aren't really small fish.
I'm not saying what these guys did.
I mean, both of those are multi. Both of those are like desi unicorns.
It was one employee at Coinbase.
It was one employee they've indicted so
far. Compared to Tether.
Sure.
Compared to Tether's $80 billion, it's fucking nothing. And I agree with him on that. It doesn't mean anything. $100,000 or $1 million or $10 million, like, that is a drop in the bucket in cryptocurrency, for sure.
Yeah. I think one product manager at Coinbase doing insider trading is probably, on the balance of things, you know, not as impactful as the actual huge issues of Luna, et cetera, et cetera. Listen, I mean, they should probably go after this guy. What he did was wrong. I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm saying I'm not entirely sure they've got the priorities right for what they decided to warn against and step up against.
Well, yeah, but even that insider trading case seems to be part of a larger push towards the SEC going after some of the unregistered securities, right? Bloomberg reported after the indictment came out that the SEC was looking into Coinbase and their listing process to see if they listed unregistered securities. So I think it's part of a broader regulatory push. It's the part we can see right now, but it's also clearly part of them going after some of these actors for that bad behavior. And like, we're talking about Luna and Terra, and Luna and Terra was clearly a failure on multiple levels, but it's one of those ones that's kind of tricky to figure out what's the point of articulation that the government should have pursued, right? Like, should it have been that Coinbase, FTX, any other exchange that has any nexus to the U.S. should have much higher standards on what they're listing, because that's going to have consequences for a whole bunch of other assets across the ecosystem as well. Is it that, like, they should have tried to aggressively pursue these international persons for selling unregistered securities, because that's a challenging case for the SEC to try to bring? Like, there was at many points in something like Luna and
They've
Terra.
They've done it before.
Yeah, no, it certainly can be done. But, like, if you look at, like, Terra, it was small. It was relatively small for most of its existence until like the last year of its existence, when they really started leaning into Anchor and the higher lending rates, and putting together an international unregistered securities case might take longer than Luna like existed during that blow up, right? And so it's kind of challenging. Like, it's understandable why Coinbase and OpenSea are targets, because they're in the US and they are doing things that are clearly wrong, and there is that clear point of articulation for US regulators to go after.
Bennett, I agree with you 100%. I think you pointed on out a few very, very important things. One of them is that regulators can go after OpenSea and Coinbase because they're US-based companies. However, that kind of, you know, is a malincentive towards, you know, maybe not being a US-based company and maybe doing the whole Binance strategy of being based everywhere and nowhere, right? So that's one part of it. That's probably not what the regulator wants. Secondly, I think what you pointed out is that, yeah, the regulators don't have a clear and easy solution to these problems, right? And what I think this sort of demonstrates is that, you know, the laws and the regulatory framework and the thinking that inspired these regulators in the 1930s might be outdated. We live in a world that's increasingly more globalized, where money can move from one corner of the world to another within minutes. That's going to have to require a new regulatory thinking, a new approach that may look very different from the one we have currently. Now, I don't have the answers, I don't have the solutions, but I believe that, you know, a proactive regulator could come up with some sort of approach where, you know, they can warn users about these sort of things, or, you know, perform some sort of advisory or some other function where hopefully less people can get hurt by this sort of activity. And it's not easy. I'll grant that. You know, the regulators aren't really in the easy spot, because all of a sudden they don't have the tools or the framework to deal with this, right? And they're also humans, right? Nevertheless, I do think it has been overall, in many ways, not an efficient way.
Oh, absolutely agreed. It's just like, I struggle a lot with things like Terra, because like in that case, you had a lot of people who could have conceivably been like tapped by regulators as subject matter experts as domain experts, who were like until the end still promoting and treating Terra and Luna as if it was going to be a sustainable thing that would continue to exist. And so like it's not clear to me that even if they were acting in some kind of advisory capacity that they would have recognized the problems and been able to act on it.
I think it's quite interesting, because a lot of people within the cryptocurrency industry who are generally cryptocurrency enthusiasts mm-hmm. did speak out and did say, hey guys, this is not good, this isn't going to work, etc. But then again, you're right, a lot of people who are, you know, VCs in this space were very
and,
much involved.
And a whole bunch of Bitcoin maxis
plenty
said,
of lawyers too.
Yeah, and like a whole bunch of Bitcoin maxis said Ethereum was never going to work, or that the merge was never going to happen, or that like, and so like the other issue there is that because cryptocurrency is so tribal, that the experts, the more deeply they are affiliated with a certain tribe, the more likely they are to describe anything outside that tribe as clearly going to fail. And when most of the things in the space do fail, a lot of them look right a lot of the time.
That's definitely true. I mean, these are very, very complex situations.
Well, absolutely.
And it's hard to know within the cryptocurrency space, how do you make sense of this whole thing, right? Because it's a complex topic. It's a fascinating topic. You guys have been following it for a couple of years. I have as well. It's fascinating. It's extremely entertaining to read and pursue, etc. But there's a lot of complexity, and it's just not possible to stay on top of things. And if you're an individual that doesn't think about this every day like you and I do, you might end up putting your money into something where you will lose all your money, right? So how do we get to a point where people understand, you could lose all your money in Anchor, right? You know, because I think most people didn't realize that.
Yeah, at least some of them didn't. There was a lot of people who didn't, including Three Arrows Capital. Just... They didn't realize Luna could do that.
So here's the other point, Bennett, that I'm very glad you brought that up, because that's actually, in my opinion, kind of also an example of regulatory failure. So the reason why Luna got so big is because a bunch of these deposit-taking schemes, like Celsius and Voyager, some of which were claiming to be FDIC insured, were lending out their customers' assets unsecured to funds like Three Arrows Capital, who then did these mad high leverage trades. That's what caused Luna to get as, you know, that's partly what caused Luna to get as big as it did. Now, we can sit here and discuss about, you know, what can regulators do about Luna, its international, unregistered security, etc., etc. Yeah, that's kind of complicated. But on the other hand, these deposit-taking institutions, which, let's face it, they're not really crypto-y.
Shadow banks.
Right? They're not decentralized. You're giving your money to some random guy. Yeah. There's no smart contract involved, you know, whatever. It's basically giving your money to some guy that promises it to give you more back.
This is a common refrain from many skeptics and critics, is that it sure feels like we're speedrunning the past 1,000 years of finance right now. It's like, oh man, yeah, you're not your keys, not your coins. Oh man, but liquidity kind of sucks. Why don't we have a centralized exchange where we can all meet up and that way we don't have to find each other peer-to-peer anymore? Oh wow, okay, that seems pretty cool. Well, yeah, what if I want to make a trade but I don't have the money to make the trade? Well, what we could do is loan you some money. But what you have to do is deposit some money and make sure that we have some sort of collateral to collect in case you don't pay back your loan. Wow, this is exactly the system that we already have. What are we doing? What are we doing, really?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Boaz, that going after some of those shadow banks, these institutions taking these deposits, these lending things, are one of the best targets for regulators and is one of the best places to do harm reduction for retail because they look so much like familiar structures but have a vastly different risk structure.
Here's my last question for both of you, guys, is that we all can agree like, oh, wow, well, 3AC should have stopped doing that and someone should have done something about that. And Celsius and Voyager and all of these institutions that were lending them money. Gosh, they shouldn't have been allowed to do that. OK, cool. I'm glad we can all agree on that. But then what do we do about it? And now, especially considering that, you know, Kyle Davies and Suzu fucking ran with their tails behind their asses to Dubai where they can't be extradited. So like, what is the solution here? Especially when scammers are actually thinking far enough ahead to be like, let's start building a yacht and move to the United Arab Emirates. If you're not stopping them before then, is it too late?
I think the cryptocurrency industry needs to, I thought this since the Luna collapse, basically. I think the cryptocurrency community and industry needs to look, you know, themselves in the eye and have, you know, a serious think about, you know, what happened to the principles that created this entire industry. What happened to the principle of self-custody? What happened to the principle of not your keys, not your coins, of, you know, do not trust, verify? What happened to, you know, censorship resistance and the need to decentralize these protocols and applications? Because what I see is that in many of the cases where people are getting hurt, you know, a lot of these core ideals of the whole, you know, cryptocurrency movement have been violated. And you had influencers, and I'm not going to name any names just because I don't remember them, but I know that they were doing this. You had influencers who on one hand were professing, you know, self-custody and, you know, not your keys, not your coins, but on the other hand were taking sponsorship deals and all making all sorts of announcements about why you should deposit your coins to whatever centralized black box yield generating instrument. I think people should look at themselves in the mirror and think, okay, like, why are we actually here, right? What is it that we actually believe in? I think that at times we may have lost sight of that, you know. I'm particularly concerned with with the more time elapses. And the further away that we get from, you know, the original founding principles of Bitcoin in terms of in time, you know, the more corners people are willing to cut and the more, kind of aimless certain parts of the entire movement become, right? So in the U.S. right now, or actually even I was at the Hungarian Grand Prix last weekend. And I saw these ads by Crypto.com. You know, what Crypto.com and FTX and all of these companies, are they really, you know, cryptocurrency sort of, you know, movement and ethos, etc., you know, self-custody, decentralization companies, or are they really about something else?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point, and probably a fair point to end on. So thank you, Boaz, for joining us. It was wonderful to finally get you on. If anyone is interested, we're starting Two Arrows Capital. We will be moving our headquarters to Pyongyang, North Korea, And we are accepting all forms of cryptocurrency. So if you want to jump in, hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and send us all your tethers.
Or don't. Okay. I'm okay if you don't. Oh, Cass. One of these times you're going to get us in trouble with those outros.